we were just having small talk and saying that it's been, I guess, 36 years or so in between visits or time here. So it's changed a lot. It's changed tremendously just at a glance, and I haven't seen the whole campus even now. It's kind of interesting that we would be where we are at this point in time. When I was here, 65 through 69, the nation was at war. The Vietnam War was ongoing, and I saw a lot of my classmates who, for whatever combination of reasons, mostly not making their grades, would get a little brown letter that said greetings, and they were gone pretty quickly. After graduation, my wife and I met here as sophomores. We graduated on the 1st of June. We got married on the 14th of June, and I went to the draft board on the 16th of June, saying, "You guys have been great, and now we're ready to go do whatever is required, you know, to help serve the nation for a couple of years." And they interestingly said, "Well, we don't need you." There had been a lottery that year, and my lottery number was like 312 out of 365. And they said, between that lottery number and the fact that, you know, we just don't have a draft requirement, we're not going to take you. So I said, "You don't understand. I want to go." And they said, "Well, you don't understand. If you want to join, go do that. But we're not going to draft you for 2 years." So that led to going up to talk to the various officers, selection officers in St. Louis, and some Marine captain there saw me come in the door and said, "You don't want to be a Marine." And I said, "I thought you were here to convince me that I did." He said, "No, no." He said, "We're coming out of Vietnam. We've got a real problem with reset. We've got the worst race problem probably of all the services brewing. It requires real leadership, and besides, I'm not sure you can make it through the training. It's pretty tough training." So at that point, the gauntlet was on the floor, and I picked it up, of course, and I think he knew exactly what he was doing in retrospect. So that's kind of how this whole thing started. And I was asked a question, "Did you ever think?" No, absolutely not. You never consider what's ahead if you're smart. You look at what you're doing. You bloom where you're planted. You do the best job you can taking care of your people. And your best focus is down in the Marine Corps, not up. In the end, that process will take care of itself if you do the right kinds of things, take care of your Marines, and just worry about the job you've got. So as a Commandant, we're attempting to do a couple of things, not to bore you with things that are happening inside Washington, D.C., but, of course, our first priority has to be our troops in contact. We've got 22,000 Marines in Iraq and a couple of hundred in Afghanistan. We're doing everything that we can and must to be able to support them in doing their job at the point of the spear. Beyond that, though, we've got to take a look at the stress and strain that is being created by the multiple deployments, and look at what we call right-sizing the force. Right now, there's individual strain in that some of our Marines are going back for a third or fourth time. And there's institutional strain that we are focusing on counterinsurgency and not doing for the nation the other things that we should be accomplishing, like jungle training, mountain warfare training, combined arms, live fire exercises, higher headquarters types of things. So what we are advocating is that we either reduce the requirement, which doesn't appear likely on the horizon, or we grow the force to the degree that we can get to what we call a 1-to-2 deployment to dwell ratio. In other words, if we're gone 7 months, which is the way the Marine Corps deploys right now, we think we need to be home 14 months to get at some of this training, to give the families more quality time together, and to lessen really the frequency that Marines are out and again at the point of the spear. And we've gotten good support for that in the building and I think through the administration. So we're guardedly optimistic at this point that those things are going to be made to happen. We want to take a look at our programs that are providing for our Marines. We're not absolutely sure yet that we're on a wartime footing with every one of them, and we're going to review our programs here pretty rapidly to make sure that we are, both for the single Marine, but as importantly for the families and for our wounded Marines. So very quickly after the first of the year, we've got what we call a best practices conference that we're going to hold to take a look at how our various units overseas, on the East Coast, on the West Coast, handle family programs, and we're going to draft in some of those great things that are happening to make them constant to provide to our families uniformly. We're also going to create what we call a wounded warrior regiment and two battalions, a battalion at Camp Pendleton, California, a battalion headquarters at Camp Lejeune, where our major troop bases are. And the thought process there is that we need to do the best job we can tracking our wounded, even after they leave the service in some instances, but while they're home on convalescent leave or in whatever capacity, to make sure that they're getting all their questions answered, that all the great people out there that want to assist our wounded have a facility to do so, that we're tied into the VA and all the programs that the nation is generating to take care of these kids. So we think that through somewhat a use of a traditional organization, something that these young men and women would be understanding of, a regimental or a battalion level construct, that we can stitch that a lot tighter and they'll be better for it in the process. So we've got several priorities. Those are just some of them. And just want to give you all some background for what we're going to be doing and pursuing in the first year of our commandancy. So I don't want to eat up too much time. I'd be happy to take your questions.
One thing that I know you had addressed before is sort of equipment and equipment wear and tear. Mm-hmm. An independent study at the end of the summer said that 40% of ground equipment, 50% of communications equipment, 20% of aviation assets have been in Iraq for over 3 years. Mm-hmm. And that at the sort of higher end, these are being used more than 9 times mm-hmm. what they were intended for. I know that's something that is concerning. How does it play out and mm-hmm. what needs to be done?
No, that's a good question, and that is one of our priorities as well. I was party to that decision. I was the MEF commander in Iraq when we had to face that first determination. Are we going to leave the gear or are we going to take it with us? And there were a couple of things. One was a safety concern for the next tranche of Marines coming in. Had we taken our gear out with us, now that would have meant that those coming in would bring their equipment and they would make the movement up from Kuwait to the Al Anbar province without benefit of armor. And we would have had to take all the armor off, transfer it over to their gear, and then people going out would have gone out the same way. So there was a physical security consideration that was part of it. But as importantly, for the long term, was the maintenance on the equipment and whether or not it would stay up. I mean, at that point, we were seeing some of those same usage rates. I mean, I think we were looking at equipment that was well past its expected life cycle based on miles that you would put on a certain frame. But it was C1. It was ready to go. It rolled every day. And so I called in our senior enlisted maintenance personnel, 6 or 7 gunnery sergeants and master sergeants around the room, and said, okay, guys, here's the issue. Right now we have what we call an amber-green board. The equipment is all pretty much ready to go, but a lot of it's past its life expectancy. So what now is the metric? How do we determine? Is there a precipice out there somewhere where we're going to fall off the cliff and we're going to go from 93% availability to 63% and we're blind to it? Are we going to continue to see what we're seeing right now? And the response uniformly was that so long as we could continue to bring in mechanics and keep the supply lines open and get the parts and those types of things, the gear is actually constructed to run when it's run hard. And so they were comfortable that it would do just what you say now. It's been there 3 years, and it's still, by and large, an ambergris board. So the problem, though, is that it may be combat-worthy, but you wouldn't want to drive it around Camp Pendleton or Camp Lejeune. Or you get a ticket, okay, because all the mirrors have been knocked off and the gauges, you knock on them and then they work kind of thing. So we do need new equipment. And then the issue becomes, do we buy new old stuff or do we buy new gear, next generation equipment? And that's how we try to take a look at each and every issue and do it smartly and reset in an intelligent fashion. The great news is the Congress understands our requirement. They've been very generous in helping to fund the requirement on an annual basis through supplementals. And the onus is on us then to be wise stewards of the resources and make sure that they're spent wisely and that there's absolutely no waste involved.
Well, having said that, the Congress is receptive. I believe you all asked for $9 billion mm-hmm. From Congress and mm-hmm. were given 5.8. Mm-hmm. Is that a correct?
There are supplementals, there are bridges to the supplementals. I'll suffice it to say that at this point, I think 100% of our requirement is going to be satisfied. I have absolutely no criticism of the Congress that they are oblivious to the issue or that they're somehow not providing us what we think we have to have. You've got those reset costs, and they're relatively set. But then you've got what I would also call the war costs, and those are on a continuing basis. So what may be in good shape today, 6 months from now, is going to be in rough cut. But again, the Congress has got the right, I think, approach and the understanding on all of that. And I just think we're going to be in good shape based upon what we see taking place.
One last point on that on that same sort of tack. You had said, and this is several years ago, that this was the first war, and you had sort of laid out these figures that of the wounded in battle, of 11, mm-hmm. one was of course fatal, mm-hmm. and out of the remaining 10, mm-hmm. seven were able to go back into combat, mm-hmm. and only three were mm-hmm. you know, sufficiently debilitated that they couldn't go anymore. Is that still the case?
Absolutely. I check it every time that particular chart is posted on what's called a battlefield update assessment. That is a report that comes out of a multinational corps daily. On Thursdays, they pay particular attention to casualties, and there is a chart there in that shows numbers of people medevac, numbers of people who are evacuated from the country, numbers of people who are returned to duty, and the average figure. It's amazing how little it varies. But it is 75% of those that are hit are wounded. I need to qualify that, are returned to duty, and that's a real tribute to the great young medics and corpsmen out there, to the speed with which we evacuate people to what we call level 2 care, operative level care, the doctors, nurses that are in these facilities under fire sometimes, actually working on patients, and then the determination that's made as to whether or not to get them back to the States for even more professional treatment, more capable treatment, or to perhaps let them recover, rehab in the facilities in Iraq. We visit the hospitals a lot, and it's amazing to see the depth of some of the wounds that people have survived and are now on their way to recovery. Doctors say this man or this woman would not have survived in Vietnam. They absolutely would not be with us any longer, and yet, they're showing signs of progress, and they're going to get capacity back, and of course, with the state of the art kinds of things that we can do with even quadriplegics today anymore. I was told the other day about a quadriplegic that sailed a sailing vessel that's owned by a VA hospital in Tampa, just using his chin, and so there's some absolutely amazing things out there that are taking place.
You mentioned three top priorities this coming year. Could you kind of reiterate those and elaborate on them a little bit?
There are actually six or seven priorities. We want to keep it fairly small, because if everything's a priority, nothing's a priority. But those that we've listed in a guidance statement that our transition team helped put out are three that I mentioned. One is a complete focus on the troops in contact. They're our first priority. Second priority is what we call right-sizing the Marine Corps to relieve some of these stresses and strains. The idea of making sure that all of our family programs and our single Marine programs are on a wartime footing. We're looking to make sure that we're as tied to the Navy as we ever have been, and that new programs facilitate this whole concept of naval warfare and its capability. If you look at the arc of instability and where that is on the globe, there's a lot of water there. And so although we're doing things, we're probably closer to the Army right now with regard to what's taking place in Iraq than we have been for a long time, our natural ties as Marines go back to the Navy. And so we want to make sure that our naval concepts to move forward at exactly the same rate. We're a little bit concerned about what we're seeing with regard to events. We've got a rape case in the Philippines that's concluding. We've got legal cases at work in Haditha and a place called Hamdaniya, at least as a result of incidents there. That's kind of unusual for us, that we would have three happening at the same time is extremely unusual. So we've told ourselves we're going to go back and take a look at our ethos, take a look at those values that we hold dear that are imprinted on a Marine from his early time at boot camp on through entry-level training, to make sure that our training is what it needs to be, that everybody understands the responsibilities, that they get the concept of a strategic corporal, a kid out there that's in charge of a squad, but that, you know, is making strategic level decisions based on how people perceive it, based on how the perceptions of his actions, all those kinds of things. So I tend to think it's coincidence, but I also think that it's incumbent on the leadership of the Marine Corps to go back and review occasionally to make sure that we haven't slipped someplace or gotten it out of balance, and there may be some tweaking that needs to take place. We want to make sure that we're posturing the Marine Corps properly for the future. And that goes just beyond the reset and the wise allocation of resources. We've got to try to look around the corner. It's tough to do that. Historically, our country doesn't do it very well. But we've got to try to look around the corner to 2020, 2025, and determine what might be out there. You know, what are the soothsayers who do this for a profession really saying about the nature of the globe? What are going to be the pressures that are brought to bear? I tend to believe that by the middle of this century, that water is going to be as important as oil, and that you're going to have huge populations along the coastal areas, once again emphasizing the importance of a naval operating team. So how do we, as what I am convinced will be a continuing superpower, help to alleviate that? How do we help to make sure that these regional strifes, where you may have even involvement of nuclear weapons, don't get out of control and are somewhat stabilized? So we've got to provide for a Marine Corps that's able to do that in 2020, 2025, and some of those programs, some of those concepts need to develop now. The only other thing to round it out is the issue of reset into modernization, and we talked some about that. But those are our priorities.
You mentioned in the past that, I think it was probably late last month, that it appeared, and there's been a lot of talk about it lately, that an increase in troops in the Marine Corps, as I understand it, is probably going to be necessary in 2007. Is that still something you believe in? And how do you think that increase will really solve? I think a lot of Americans are probably wondering, mm-hmm. How is 20,000 more troops going to do the job and get the job done?
Yeah. You're talking about Iraq, or you're talking about inside the Marine Corps?
Yeah.
Well, there's discussion. The president is undergoing a strategy review right now. He was in the Pentagon with us on Wednesday in the tank. He is gathering a lot of recommendations, advice, opinion, perspective from mm-hmm. from a lot of different quarters, and I think he is considering a strategy change from where we've been. I emphasize the word considering. I don't know that there will be a change announced, but one of them, of course, is that you would add five brigades or more to the mix right now in Iraq. We would fully support, I think, as a Joint Chiefs, the idea of putting more troops into Iraq if there is a solid military reason for doing so. If there is something to be gained by the commitment of five more brigades, then we think timing is critical to that whole concept. But I don't think that we believe, in fact, I can tell you we do not believe, that just adding numbers for the sake of adding numbers, just thickening the mix, is necessarily a good way to go. Part of that is because you look at where those five brigades would come from. Right now, those five brigades, our regiments in our case, are in training, getting ready to go back again. So if you reach down and pull those forward, that represents what we call in military parlance a surge. Well, by definition, if you surge something to bring forward troops to put them in now, you sacrifice something later on. And so we might go for greater capability right now, but in the end, there will be a lesser capable rotation down here, paying back that surge, if you will. It's analogous to an operational commander committing his reserve. You can commit your reserve, but you better make sure that your timing is right, because if you commit the reserve for something other than a decisive win or to stave off defeat, then you have essentially shot your bolt and you don't have that capability redundant again. So if the president decides it's the right thing to do, I think right along with that determination will be an establishment of the military objectives that this additional force is expected to accomplish, a prescribed amount of time that he hopes to get it done. And then it'll be on us to go back and say, okay, how do we then now structure this surge payback on downrange and what happens there in Iraq?
What do you think should happen, I mean, if you had it your way?
Those are two different questions. I think that I think the Iraqi government is understanding now that their position of allowing the militia to be as active as they are, the sort of internecine discussions and arguments and stymieing of forward progress of the government is having a tremendous impact on their people. The role of any government is to protect your people, and they're simply not doing that. And this government now has been in place for about 9 months, and they have not yet shown the progress that I think is absolutely essential in any government to get on towards governing effectively, efficiently, and protecting your folks. We have augmented that as appropriate. We've tried to help. But on 24 June of 2004, Iraq became a sovereign country. And there's a portion of the Iraqi people that don't want us there. I mean, and frankly, we've got other things we need to be doing. We don't want to stay there forever. So the sooner that government can get on its feet and start legislating and start protecting its people, providing the security so that other functions that a nation has to perform are provided for, the happier we're all going to be. And I think now the Maliki government is starting to get that. He's making a major speech today. You know, check the airwaves and see what he says. Making a major speech today that I think are going to get away from some of this divisiveness and get on more towards trying to be inclusive and stop the silliness that's associated with the sectarian violence and all that kind of thing. You know, I learned here that a successful nation has five things: arable land, a fresh water supply, an intelligent population, an educable population, a natural resource, and a seaport. I would add to that probably leadership. But Iraq has got all those things. Iraq is potentially a very rich country. And I was just reading today that the mothers and the wives are getting really fed up with it. Maybe that's what's needed to happen. I don't know. But they're getting fed up with the fact that the schools are being closed, that their children are being kidnapped. And I think I think at some point there's going to be a saturation, a level of aggravation that's going to make this thing all better. Now that's what I think is incumbent on the Iraqi government to make happen. We can support that, and that's been our methodology ever since 2004. It's not been win or lose in the case of the U.S. military. That's the wrong paradigm. It's been are we going to be able to have the Iraqis on their feet sooner or later? And of course, we would prefer sooner. There is a little bit of an issue here. Maybe it's a major issue with regard to the timing. These things take time. But I don't know that the belief in our country is that we've got a lot more time. I think that our American population would like to see a much more livable product much faster than what we're seeing on the deck in Iraq. And there's a basic disconnect there that I think, you know, we need to work on. We need to have our people understand as best they can what is going on, the threat that's there, the absolute danger that exists if we do come out of Iraq less than fully satisfied that it's going to be able to stand on its feet and not become a safe haven for terrorists or for insurgents. So it's very important that we achieve end state in Iraq, which basically is a stable country able to provide basic services to its country and in time able to defend itself against its regional partners.
Is there a number one thing you think the American public may not be as aware of as people on the ground are? I know you've talked before about sort of media skewing things going on in Iraq towards all negative. Is there one thing you could point to that maybe we'd be surprised?
I think there's two things, really. One is the level of normalcy that's taking place in probably 14 of the 18 provinces, and the successes that are being enjoyed sort of at the micro level in a lot of those locations. Even in the Al Anbar province, there's some good things taking place that our troops see on a day in and day out basis, give them cause for encouragement, cause them to believe that it is a slow process, but it is a favorable process that's taking place. I've talked to a lot of troops just since 13 November in a passage of command. And a lot of them have been to Iraq. A lot of them are freshly home. And I say, how many of you believe that the Iraq that you read about in the media is the Iraq that you just saw? And not a hand goes up. And there's a little bit of a disillusionment there that I think just about every returning serviceman, from all services, I suppose, has to sort of undergo or experience to say, well, that may be true, but that's not balanced. That's not the whole story. And so I just think that that more balance could be applied to what is being reported day in and day out, sort of chasing the casualty count and the explosions in Baghdad, those kinds of things. The second thing that I think our people do need to understand is that if we pull out of Iraq with anything less than complete satisfaction, our ability to say that we have succeeded, it's about success or failure, not win or lose it. But if we pull out of Iraq and we don't consider that we have succeeded, there's going to be a tremendous loss of American credibility and the perception of American power, all elements of power, and it's going to be a lot more dangerous world. I saw a pretty good article, in fact, a week ago today in the Washington Post, and it talked about, it said, we'll be back. And this guy was prophesizing that if we accept something less than in-state, satisfactory in-state coming out of Iraq, that there are a number of bad turns that could take place over there. The Iranians think they've got momentum now after what happened with Israel and the Hezbollah sort of model. The oil, of course, and the pricing and all those types of things could be very adversely influenced. Our economy could be turned on its side by insurgents or even terrorists, affecting or controlling the oil supply coming out of that part of the world. And we could be forced to act again. That was the essence of this article, is that we can't allow that because that gets at our nation's vital interest. And so it's either do it right now before we come out or risk having to go back if some of those very untoward things could happen in the Middle East, not the least of which, again, is Israel being threatened by I think, the strategic surprise that they experienced and the relative success of the Hezbollah in taking on the Israeli army. So there's some signs there that I think we just have to take note of and make sure that as we do our strategic planning that we realize that it's a very unstable world right now, at least in that part of it. So we need to tread wisely and with deliberation.
Does the Joint Chiefs have the ear of the president to the degree? I mean, it's been reported that in the run-up to war and even mm-hmm. the early stages of war, perhaps Donald Rumsfeld kind of tried to silence the mm-hmm. Joint Chiefs. I don't know if that's been...
I can't speak to that.
Yeah.
I was out on the West Coast at the time, worried about other types of things.
Sure.
But I can tell you that the session Wednesday was fabulous. It went longer than scheduled. The chairman told us, and I don't think I'm talking out of school, yesterday that the president's advisors thought it was a wonderful session and want to do more on downrange. The incoming Secretary of Defense was there, and I think he liked what he saw because he wants to have sessions with the Joint Chiefs regularly in the tank. So I think it was a very wholesome session and a lot of good ideas exchanged, really coming from both sides. We made some recommendations to the president. He tried some ideas out on us. So it was a great dialogue from both sides of the table.
Anything else?
Go ahead.
What about Iran and Syria? What does it play into the whole picture? And what, in your view, should the U.S. do about those potential threats?
Yeah. Well, that's part of what the president is looking at right now. I think it's fair to say, again, that... because of what happened in southern Lebanon, with the support of the Hezbollah, both on the part of Iran and Syria, that they have gained a momentum in the region that should be a little disconcerting to us all. That if they feel like that they can create that kind of a model and employ it elsewhere, that it could be destabilizing in other parts of the region. The countries, the other moderate countries in the region, I know are concerned with it. Certainly wouldn't speak for them, but they have always been concerned about Iran, not even a nuclear Iran. So if Iran takes on that kind of a capability through development, I think that just exacerbates what they've seen as a threat in the region for a long time. Iran has, and Syria neither, have been helpful to the efforts in Iraq. I think that there is a danger out there that this whole sectarian thing could spread throughout the region. And I don't think they want that, but at the same time, I don't sense that from a strategic perspective they want to see the United States succeed necessarily either. So I think there's some terrain there that they're trying to stay on that that both keeps us engaged, but at the same time doesn't exacerbate the sectarianness taking place. So the president is, based on the Hamilton Baker and based upon other advice he's receiving, is getting a whole range of recommendations in terms of what to do about that. One side says you got to negotiate with these people. We talked with the Soviets all the way through the Cold War. Why wouldn't we talk with the Iranians and the Syrians? Another side says no. If we go talk to them now, all you do is reflect weakness in a region that looks for those signals. And so to change policy now would simply be an indication to some people that we're desperate and we're looking for ways to try to make this thing better through proxy. So I don't know what he's going to do, frankly. We'll have to see how that whole thing sorts out. That's political. That's not necessarily the things that the Joint Chiefs deal with on a routine basis. So we're going to have to allow his other advisors to make best recommendations to him there on how those things are managed. Ours has much more to do with the operational and the strategic taking place inside Iraq.
Speaking of that, do you think the focus in the coming year, 2 years, is going to be more on the combat side of things or on the training, or both, of Iraqi forces?
Yeah. You mean for the Iraqi forces?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's going to we're going to train the Iraqi forces to succeed in combat. That's what any military does. It defends its nation. So our first concern will be that they're able to be effective in a counterinsurgency role. In time, we're going to have to make sure that they have a powerful enough army and navy and air force to defend themselves regionally against an Iran or a Syria should they want to come over the borders and perhaps try to steal their wealth. But the country needs a lot more than that. That's just one aspect to it. While we're helping their military to establish security, there are other what we call lines of operation out there that we've got to help them work. That'll get the rest of the country back up on its feet. You know, the economic, the international relations, their infrastructure is really pretty poor. Not brought on by the war, but brought on by 30 years of neglect before that under Saddam. So, number of lines of operation there that need to be influenced. The military, U.S. military, can help with a lot of it. But one of the points that we made to the president was that we also need to engage other elements of American power to get in, assist the Iraqi ministries, assist them with their negotiations, American business, American agriculture, a lot of things that the Iraqis can learn from us that will, I think, speed their efforts to try to get themselves back on their feet. So while we're working a security perspective with the Iraqi army, there's lots of other functional areas in the country that also need to be engaged.
If this is sort of on a different subject, but if someone were to run into you when you were an undergraduate here at Southeast Missouri State, what would they have known you for? How would you have been known around here?
I wouldn't have been known around
really?
Here.
Why is that?
For the most part, I was pretty amorphous. I was a member of a Sigma Phi Epsilon fraternity from my freshman year, second semester freshman year on. I was president of the fraternity my junior year, and I was the IFC president, Interfraternity Council president my senior year. I like to party, do the athletics inside the intramural construct. And not much beyond that. I mean, I was not involved in much else on the campus, honestly.
They wouldn't have said this is going to be the next future commandant.
Oh, I don't think anybody would have said that.
Okay.
I think so.
But do, Do you have any, you know, particularly fond memories, vivid memories of Southeast Missouri State?
Oh, I have a ton of them. They just driving up Sprigg Street today, you know, brought a million of them back. I had this crazy fraternity brother. His name was Rich Gellner, and he was a handsome guy. He had been chasing some girl at a party though, and ran through a plate glass window, so he had a scar that kind of ran across his face. But in any event, he had a 1963 Chevrolet Impala convertible. And on Friday afternoons, Rich would drive around campus with a surfboard in the back of his convertible yelling, "Surf's up." But what that connoted to us was that there was going to be a beer bust out on the creek starting at 3 o'clock. So any classes after 3 o'clock on a Friday afternoon were definitely in jeopardy, you know, if you were going to follow Richie's lead and go out and drink beer with your buddies and figure out what you were going to do in life. That one comes immediately to mind. He lived over on Sprigg Street. We passed his house coming up here today.
Okay. You're going to be addressing the student body today, right?
Mm-hmm.
During the commencement. What's going to be, you know, your overall message? Are you going to be talking about the war? Are you going to be talking about, what are you going to talk
yeah,
about?
Yeah, okay, fair. I'm going to talk to them, first of all, about it's great that they're graduating from Southeast Missouri. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter where you graduate from, a college degree, you get your foot in the door, and after that, it's performance, whatever your chosen part in life. Give them a little vignette on how I saw that firsthand in Iraq. I don't. Are you all going to be at the speech?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I don't know.
Yeah. I had a number of my subordinate commanders when I was a CG at 1MEF come up to me, Marine Expeditionary Force come up to me, and say that they had graduated from SEMO. Do we still call it SEMO? I haven't seen that in any of the literature, but have we gotten away from that?
Well, we've gotten away from it
okay.
to some extent,
yeah.
but we
okay.
still use it in athletics a lot.
Yeah, okay. In any event, I was surprised, and so I asked my G1, my personnel officer, after a time, I said, figure out for me, look at all of our commanders, lieutenant, colonel, and above that are in the MEF, and this is probably about 60,000 Marines. We had some folks from the East Coast join us. I said, figure out for me which college or university has contributed the largest number of commanders. And let me just hesitate to say that. Being a commander in the Marine Corps is a big deal. There's a command screen program. You're selected. You're assigned. And if you're going to be a career officer, that's something you want to do. Well, they came back after just a few days and said, okay, the Naval Academy provided 3. The Citadel provided 3. Virginia Military Institute, 2, Texas A&M, 2, and Southeast Missouri State University, 6. And I was just absolutely floored. And I'd met these guys. In fact, four of the six were aviators, and 3 of the 6 were fraternity brothers. They were from Sigma Phi Epsilon. So how that happens, I have no idea, but it's absolutely amazing to me. So I'm just going to make that point, is that, you know, wherever you come from and whatever you do, it's when you get out there, it's just work hard, bloom where you're planted again, and you'll be fine. I think that one of the things that colleges and universities maybe don't do as effectively as they should, if you consider that people with a college degree are going to be in a leadership role in some capacity, is teach leadership. You know, we do in the military academies, of course, and we do if you choose to join the military. But I don't remember any leadership 101 flunk-out courses, you know, or I probably would have tried to get into one. So I'm going to lay on the graduates 2 or 3 golden BBs from Marine Corps style leadership, suggestions to them that they might consider as they go on downrange. And then I am going to talk about the war a little bit. Some of the things we've talked about here, the fact that I'm not sure our countrymen fully understand the danger that may be emanating out of this thing. I'm going to ask them to do a couple things. One is to better understand it, get informed, and help our administration to make decisions. Do that through your elected officials, those types of things. But then I want to ask them to continue to support the troops too. When I was in school during Vietnam, I think the belief was if you're against the government's policy, you're also against the troops. And we saw some things happen in the country that probably never should have happened in terms of how the men and women were treated when they came back and when they wore the uniform. I can't tell you how many people have told me that they went to the men's room at San Francisco International and got out of the uniform as soon as they could. That should never be the case. I think the country has matured immensely since then, and now I think you can disagree with the policy if you want to, but still support the troops, and I see that happening by and large, and I hope people will continue to do that. I got to tell you, I don't have any doubts that that's going to happen in this area. The heartland is a great place to be from, because the values that you learn here that are maintained are just marvelous. I mean, hard work, common sense, love of country, those are the things that, I'll tell you, make great young Marines and soldiers, but they also are very helpful for the nation. That's it. That's what I'm talking about.
Okay.
Yeah, it will be brief. I don't know that graduation speakers are held in much esteem if you go very long.
Is joining the military now a harder sell than it has been in years past?
We are not having any trouble with our recruiting. There's a recent study out that shows propensity to join, and study has shown that the propensity is somewhat down right now. Now, to answer your question properly, you'd have to go back and check to see where that line is on a scale from 10 years ago. I honestly don't know the answer to that. Marine Corps has always done very well in recruiting. There have been very few times where we haven't made our quota. Of course, we're smaller, and we look for a certain kind of individual, and those great young men and women are out there by and large. But this propensity study did show that amongst Caucasians, Hispanics, and blacks, the propensities are all down some. And my son's a recruiter. He runs a recruiting station up in New Hampshire. And he would tell you that we get great young people, and they're joining for the right reasons. He said if he had more infantry quotas to hand out each month, he would have no problem getting his numbers. But what we're experiencing is that the influencers, the teachers, the parents, the coaches, are less inclined to make recommendations these days to join the military and get squared away and come out and do something else than perhaps they were. My son Brandon said that it used to be that you spent about an equal amount of time talking to the recruitee as you did his parents. Now that number is grossly out of that balance. They say about 4 hours sit-down time to convince a young man or woman that the Marine Corps is right for them. It's now about 14 hours of sitting down convincing their parents that it's the right thing for them to do as a family. So that's a lot different from what it used to be. And of course, you know, you gauge the market and you talk to your recruiters and see what tools then they need to be able to do those things and your system. But we've had good success. We continue to have good success. We have our retention, our reenlistment rates are all right where we want them to be, and we believe that we can recruit even more in order to do some of this growth that we're talking about to right size the Marine Corps.
You said right size a couple times. What does right sizing mean again? I mean, I'm struggling to understand that.
Yeah. Okay. I've got a study group at Quantico, Virginia, which is where our education facilities are for the most part, but it's also where we integrate all of our air, ground, logistics communities for balance, for procurement, those types of things. I've got the commanding general down there doing a study, and it's running parallel. It's to tell me what is 1-2. If our objective here is based upon the current demand of forces to be able to deploy a unit for 7 months and have it home for 14 months, what size Marine Corps do we need to be able to do that? Right now, we're at about 180. We're going to be authorized soon to go to about 185. We're not at 1-1. We're not at 1-2. We're at about 1-1.something, 2 or 3, depending upon what type unit you have. So what we need then is to create more units, not more people to put into these units. We need more units to be able to take rotation. And if you accept that a 1-2 ratio is about right, we need 3 of everything to have that unit in Iraq, whatever type unit that is, or whatever the number of those units are. So that's right sizing. And whatever that number turns out to be, then we're going to ask ourselves, okay, do we want to grow the active duty force to that size and not ask for another authorization for our reserves? Or do we want to say, okay, we have 39,000 reserves in the Marine Corps. If we use our reserves or yet another authorization, that means we'll need less on active duty in order to be able to do this one to two thing. So, and that's going to be a determination that will be probably a policy issue, not just a Marine Corps issue, tied to how the Army's doing it, how the Air Force is doing it, so that there's an element of fairness out there for our reserves and Guard. And that will be a decision that's made on downrange.
And one to two, again, just means that it's a ratio between...
Yeah, if you're a young Marine and you're deployed for 7 months, yep. Okay, that's what we call boots on the ground time in Iraq. When you come home, it's going to be for 14 months. And there's a level of predictability about that, that you say, okay, I'm here for 14 months before I have to worry about going again. Now, part of that 14 months is going to be spent in training, getting ready. You'll be with your unit doing some things, but a good part of that's going to be family time and trying to balance, you know, the requirements.
And Marines have not been spending that 14 months at home.
It's been 7 and 7, roughly. It's been about 1-to-1, maybe a little better than that. Maybe you're home for 8 or 9 months, maybe 10 months, depending upon your unit. But we also have some that aren't getting 1-to-1. Some of our Cobra squadrons are home for about 5 months before they turn around and go again. And so it's just putting a strain on these youngsters that we think we've got to do something about. We want to keep them around, those that want to stay, and that'll be a large chunk of them. And we want to make sure that you know, Mama is as happy as a young Marine is out there doing good work.
Sir, I think we've got time for one more.
Okay.
How long do you think we'll continue to be in Iraq? Do you have a timetable? What are your thoughts on that?
No, I think timetables are dangerous. I think timetables are known by the bad guy, and the belief right now with the insurgents in Iraq is if they can simply maintain the status quo and draw this thing out, eventually our public will tire of it, and it will cause us to come home. I think anything that sort of gives them, you know, what our indication of national will is not healthy. So I would not support, you know, a predetermined timetable that says that this is when we must look at going from X number to X number and then down below that. Now, a reasonable timeline that says we think that President Maliki has said he thinks that by June of next year that the Iraqis will be ready to take it on. Well, that's great. And if that happens in June, so much the better. If that slides to August or September, okay, then the objective is the same. It's just that the timeline has slid some. So what I would say is that we make it conditions-based. And when we achieve this certain condition, then we go to the next step, whatever that is, and we move it down in that regard. So, but an established time, a mark on the wall, a mark on the calendar, is not something I think is helpful where you're trying to accomplish certain things on the ground.
And establishing that 1-to-2 ratio you mentioned before, you're advocating an increase in the number of Marines.
I think that's fair, because you can get to 1-to-2 really two ways with us. One is to reduce the requirement. The other one is to grow the force.
Right.
And there could be a reduction in the requirement out there. Again, the president is going to make a major speech here, I think, next month now. And there could be some component of that in there. Don't see it coming. And so then logically, so as not to waste time, we say, okay, let's grow the force. The other thing is 1-to-2 is good for Iraq. But this Iraq and Afghanistan are battles in this long war. We have to have a capability out beyond that. And so, you know, what we're also doing is building capacity for the unknown out there if something else should break that we need to respond to. Okay?
Appreciate y'all coming.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks, guys. Pleasure.
All right.
My tape recorder.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much.
Appreciate it.
Thanks very much for your time.
Okay.
Appreciate it. Nice to meet you. Good luck today.
Thank you.
I know this might be difficult, but
thanks very much, Marine.
Yes, sir. I'm going to follow you around. Right. You talk to the other Marines.
And I was wondering, I have a computer. I was wondering if you have an adapter. I can load that onto my computer.
Yeah, just make sure you find me before I get back on the plane to go home.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, I don't.
Oh, the adapter. Yeah.
Yeah. Just, yeah,
the firework.
I'll give you my cover there.
Thank you. Yeah, that's great. It's a small crowd, but really good questions. I wish Connie wouldn't miss it, because we were definitely hoping to hit the radio.
Some radio, that would be nice.